J.S. Bach. Arvo Pärt, numbers. Honey, what's the connection?
Bach,
back,
bark,
park or bart.
Part to pet. Part,
packed,
pack
and back
to Bach.
Find out
tomorrow evening at 7:45
on BBC Radio 3. Bach and the Art of Beekeeping.
Yes, the common denominators and extra musical connections from the art of fugue to quantum mechanics and the structure of the honeycomb, a fascinating journey in our Sunday feature this week. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon today on Radio 3. Music written for you by Handel. Next, this afternoon, Kitty Clive was the lucky lady who had the great master compose music for her, but she did make other musicians famous too, like Thomas Arne. We wouldn't know Rule Britannia without her influence, as you'll hear in the early music show, which follows a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime from Vaughan Savage.
It's emerged that the chairman of Royal Bank of Scotland, Sir Philip Hampton, has given up a £1.4 million share reward he was due to receive this year. The development follows the controversy about the company's chief executive, Stephen Hester, being awarded a bonus of £963,000. Ed Miliband has accused David Cameron of going to ground to avoid questions about the bonus awarded to Stephen Hester. He's urged the government to use its position as the majority shareholder in RBS to block the payment at the bank's annual general meeting in April. The Chancellor, George Osborne, has dismissed the idea, saying it would amount to the government interfering in the day-to-day running of the bank. A serving police officer and four other men have been arrested by detectives investigating corrupt payments to police. The BBC understands the four men are former senior journalists at the Sun newspaper. The arrests are part of a long-running operation linked to the phone hacking inquiry. Campaigners for gay marriage have criticised remarks by the Archbishop of York, in which he warned the government didn't have the authority to allow same-sex couples to marry. In an interview for the Daily Telegraph, Dr. John Sentamu said although he'd seen dictators redefine marriage, it wasn't up to the state to change such historic social structures. Anti-government activists in Syria say as many as 14 people have been killed this morning, including two children, in further clashes with the security forces. Diplomatic efforts are intensifying at the United Nations Security Council to bring an end to the violence. Cricket. England have slumped to humiliating defeat in the second test in Abu Dhabi after bowling out Pakistan for 214. Chasing just 145 to win, they have just been dismissed for 72. The weather, it's a bright day in many areas, especially parts of Wales and northern England, but scattered showers will affect the far southeast of England. Cloud will increase across Northern Ireland and Western Scotland, with occasional rain developing through the afternoon. The BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
Vaughan, thank you very much. Well, in an hour from now on Radio 3, a chance to hear our live relay from Wigmore Hall last Monday when the Tokach Quartet took the stage at Wigmore Hall in London to play string quartets by Haydn and by Dvorak. Our lunchtime concert is at 2 this afternoon. Then Simon Heffer continues his fascinating tour of the British Isles with music both familiar and less so composed by British composers. Today there's a chance to hear part of George Lloyd's Mammoth Fourth Symphony. He'll also be guiding you through songs by Finzi Butterworth and Cecil Sharp, and introducing you perhaps to Gordon Jacobs' Trombone Concerto. Saturday Classics begins this afternoon at 3 here on Radio 3. But now it's time to join Lucy Skeeping for today's edition of the Early Music Show.
Welcome to the show. We're focusing today on one of early music's great characters, an actress and singer who was a huge celebrity in her day, a star of the London theatres whose powerful voice and daring wit fascinated audiences for decades. Her name is Kitty Clive. And we're going to hear examples of some of the music she made famous. Rule Britannia was one, along with some of Handel's most gorgeous arias and lots more. And we're also going to hear about some of the people she met in the course of her glittering career.
Thank you.
Music from Handel's pastoral ode, L'Allegro il Penseroso ed il Moderato. That was the air, Mirth, Admit Me of Thy Crew, performed there by Clara McFadden with the King's Consort, directed by Robert King. It was the soprano Kitty Clive that audiences would have heard singing that piece if they'd been lucky enough to get a ticket for the performance of the work at Lincoln's Inn Fields Theatre in January 1740. Kitty Clive was the hot ticket of the day. And with me in the studio to discuss her colourful life and work is the musicologist Berta Jonkers, who's currently writing a book about the great 18th century soprano. Thank you so much for coming in, Berta.
It's my pleasure.
Now, tell us a little about Kitty Clive's beginnings. I mean, she put into show business at a very young age by her mother or something.
Not at all. The remarkable thing about Clive's career is that she had no theatrical connections, no network to work through, which was the norm of the day. She made friends with a woman called Jane Cibber, who was the wife of Theophilus Cibber, and we think that's how she got an audition with the manager, and from there, she got hired.
But was it deemed to be a respectable profession in those days, I mean, being on the stage?
No, it was very risque. It was precisely a moment in which they were moving away from the restoration license of the theatre. So there was still very much a whiff of the prostitute actress that made the acting career, particularly for women, something that was frowned upon in most middling orders circles. Yet at the same time, it was so lucrative. And it was one of the very few professions, and perhaps the only profession, in which a woman could make her career on the same basis as a man.
In a moment, we're going to hear an aria from The Beggar's Opera. What was Kitty's connection with that?
The Beggar's Opera was the first ballad opera ever produced. And what happened was that Drury Lane, having fastened on to Kitty Clive and knowing she was a great singer, mounted a series of other ballad operas. And Clive, through her public acclaim, became known as the Queen of Ballad Opera. And she ended up singing in the Beggar's Opera herself several years later after its premiere in 1728.
Bronwyn Mills and the Broadside Band, directed by Jeremy Barlow, with Now Ponder Well from John Gay's The Beggar's Opera. Berta, that aria was sung to great acclaim by Kitty Clive, but in fact the role had first been made famous by the actress and singer Lavinia Fenton. Did the two know each other?
Probably not personally, because Fenton was at the Rival Theatre and retired the very same season that she premiered in that work. Once Fenton so-called retired, that's when Clive stepped in. There was a kind of talent vacuum, and that's when Drury Lane started to produce all these new ballad operas.
Now, you mentioned Kitty's association with the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. Was this part of a contract, rather like the old Hollywood studio system, so that she worked exclusively for them?
It was exactly like that. There were two so-called patent theatres in London at the time. There were officially no other theatres allowed, although there were many other theatres operating at the time. But to have a contract with one of the main theatres, of course, was the most prestigious post that you could hold as an actress. And Clive spent practically all of her career at Drury Lane. That's where the theatre she was identified with.
We were talking about ballad opera, obviously the Beggar's Opera being the first of them. Kitty Clive was a very important player in the whole genre of the ballad opera. It's quite interesting, though, isn't it? Because they didn't just use sort of popular tunes of the day, but it seems that these ballad operas took arias from quite respectable sources and threw them in as well. Can you explain how that worked?
The fascinating thing about ballad opera music is the way the playwrights were able and willing and eager to plunder any music that happened to be lying around, and that included all the Italian operas, but most importantly, it included the music of Handel. And I think that's, I've written about this, I think that's really how those who could not afford to go to the opera first got to know Handel's music, was through ballad opera. They were produced hundreds of times throughout the century. There were all kinds of publications, and Handel's music was most popular source for tunes that at the day. In this particular instance for Clive, it was important because it was from Handel's opera Ottone that they took a baritone aria, actually, that had originally been a rage aria, and adapted it as a duet, a love duet of all things, for Clive to sing, and that became her most important first musical hit.
Thank you.
Was Ever a Man Possessed, performed by Mary Bevan and Greg Tassel, with La Ventura London, directed by Jacques Osmo. It's an aria from Handel's opera Ottone, which became a smash hit after it was adapted in 1731 for Kitty Clive to sing in the ballad opera The Devil to Pay, which is the way we've just heard it. So, Berta Jonkers, this was a time, wasn't it, when there was a great rise in patriotism, a sort of national fervour, wasn't there, that produced all sorts of specifically British musical stage works. One of the works that I think Kitty Clive performed in was a revival of The Mask Comus.
Yes.
How did that work on the stage?
Well, what they did is they basically took the libretto from Milton and they added wholesale new musical numbers and dances, which were very important as well. And they brought in Thomas Arne to supply the music. It was actually probably Arne's first great success in the theatre. Clive was probably the most important singer in that, although there was also John Beard was up and coming at the time. But we can see and hear Clive's importance in this work in the music that Arne composed in order to showcase what the kind of music she was known for.
Thank you.
song that needs no introduction, I guess. That was Catherine Bott with the tenor Joseph Cornwell with the famous Rule Britannia, music by Thomas Arne, an aria from his Masque Alfred. So, Berta, Thomas Arne was obviously impressed by Kitty Clive's talents, but of course, nevertheless, the greatest composer in London at the time was Handel himself, and he was, at this time, very keen to establish himself as a British composer, wasn't he? So did he jump in immediately and write songs for Kitty Clive?
There was certainly a kind of makeover going on in Handel's public persona at the time, and Clive was a perfect mouthpiece, new mouthpiece, as it were, for his music. So he started off writing some theatre music for her to sing in her plays. But the biggest publicity splash was for his oratorio season, and we could look at it as a kind of comeback oratorio season for Handel, because he had been in Dublin and he was coming back to London with none other than the score of Messiah. And what he did was he then took the score and he adapted it for the new singers he had at his disposal at Covent Garden, and among them were, of course, Kitty Clive. So what he did is he composed new music just for Clive. According to the tradition of the London stage, he followed her established persona, which was that of a singing shepherdess. So he included this music for her in the Pifa section of Messiah.
But
Ellie Ammerling, directed by Neville Marriner, with There Were Shepherds, a recit not traditionally part of Messiah, but inserted specially by Handel for the much-celebrated soprano Kitty Clive to sing at the very first performance in London of Messiah, which was on the 23rd of March 1743, and it took place at Covent Garden Theatre. But Handel and Kitty Clive had a good working relationship, and he wrote all sorts of other things for that season, didn't he?
He did, and most significantly, he wrote Samson with the role of Dalilah, especially crafted for Clive for her public persona and for her vocal skills. It was all designed around her. This is a Clive vehicle, as it were. What you will here is a soprano calling forth to her followers, who then answer her in an antiphonal fashion. And the movement itself is based on Baroque dance. And it was exactly the same kind of format that was used in Comus. I'm not saying that Handel actually copied Arne, but I'm saying that he was inspired by Clive and her earlier music.
Linda Russell and Lynn Dawson there with The 16 and the Symphony of Harmony and Invention, directed by Harry Christophers. And they were singing the duet My Faith and Truth from Handel's Sampson. You're listening to me, Lucy Skeeping, here on BBC Radio 3 with the Early Music Show. And my guest in the studio is Berta Jonkers, who is a musicologist and author of a book about Kitty Clive, the famous comedian and singer of London in the 18th century. Now, Berta, it was fascinating to read about the sort of financial problems these theatres like Drury Lane and Covent Garden had. There were obviously a lot of competition for funding. And at one point, Charles Fleetwood, who was the manager of Drury Lane Theatre, went bankrupt. So who took over?
Well, at that point, it was a man called James Lacey, another actor, but he had city money behind him, just like today. He could then take over the patent, and then a few years later, David Garrick came along and bought up half of that patent. So originally it was Lacey, then it was David Garrick. Once Garrick came on board, they really started to move ahead with this revival of Shakespeare that had been ongoing since the mid-1730s. The Shakespeare revival brought with it a certain kind of music, and once again Thomas Arne was called upon to supply all kinds of songs for the actresses who could sing, among them of course Clive. And there's some charming music that he produced that Clive then also became identified with in the latter part of her career.
And these songs were not just popular in the theatre, were they? So they sort of spread Kitty Clive's fame further, because people would buy sheet music of their favourite hit song in the shops and take it home to play around the harpsichord at home, yeah, if they had one.
Yes. It's interesting how the domestic music making of the day was so important to the kinds of music that was then produced on the London stage. There was a kind of reciprocal relationship with the eye to the market that was there. And interestingly, that market was driven by women, actually. Women were assumed to be the main music makers in the home. And songs like the ones written for Clive and sung by Clive would have been very popular, I'm sure, among the ladies at home.
Well, we're going to hear one of them now. This is a song from As You Like It, When Daisies Pied, with the music by Thomas Arne. It's interesting, though, because below the title, it said As Sung by Mrs. Clive, which was obviously the best form of advertising of all.
Tree, fox married men.
Where Daisies Pied, a song from Shakespeare's As You Like It in a setting by Dr. Arne. That was Catherine Bott with the Parley of Instruments, directed by Peter Holman. So Kitty Clive was, by all accounts, not only an excellent singer, but she was also a good actress too. But Berta, what's really interesting to me is that she tried her hand at writing plays as well. That adds a whole new dimension to her character, which I really like, which is also quite unusual, I guess, for an 18th century woman.
Yes, it was extremely unusual, the period. There had been an earlier brief flourishing of female playwrights at the end of the 17th century, but in the 18th century, the number of female playwrights plummeted, and it was seen as a great public shame to be a female playwright. Women were not supposed to publish, just in the same way as women were not supposed to appear on the London stage. And somehow Clive managed to negotiate both of these taboos, partly, I think, by writing pieces in which she mocked herself. She was doing a send-up of her own character at the time. So that was seen as acceptable just because it was so funny.
So we're going to hear an example of Kitty Clive's writing. It's a piece called Corydon and Miranda. Tell us about it. And, of course, who wrote the music?
Well, the music was by William Boyce and the libretto was by Kitty Clive. And what it was a kind of musical insert into this larger farce that she had written. It was still a fairly short farce, but it was a play within a play. It was a rehearsal play in which Clive then replaced the traditional comedy that would have been rehearsed within the play and stuck in music instead so that she could sing it and also at the same time mock the entire genre and mock herself. So although on the surface this seems a kind of bog standard pastoral story of the jealous shepherdess, one would have to reimagine Clive performing this piece of music in which she would have lampooned herself by exaggerating, I believe, the kind of hot-tempered shepherdess that's being represented in the music. Clive, by this time, was well known for her hot temper. In fact, she'd had a rather big row with a rival, Peg Woffington, backstage, which had spawned a huge scandal. It was called the Green Room Scuffle. So, in a sense, what this pastoral does is it plays off of that particular little scandal and sets it to music by William Boyce.
Thank you. not a capricious fair. One smile from thee is worth possession there.
Did I not hear her in yon hawthorn bower, with transport boast all Corydon her power? In vain, Miranda, you complain and charge the guiltless boy in vain, who ne'er proved untrue, who ne'er proved untrue. In vain, Miranda, you complain and charge the guiltless boy in vain, who ne'er proved untrue, who ne'er proved untrue. The sweetest image thought can find, the best idea of my mind, my soul is filled with you, my soul is filled with you. Thou sweetest image thought can find, thou best idea of my mind, my soul is filled with you. My soul is filled with you. Let not those eyes deny me bright, that look the language of delight, a spacious globe review. If they can smile and be be jealous then, and I'll take care you shall have reason to, you shall have reason to. If you can spy an equal fair, be jealous then, and I'll take care you shall have reason to. Be jealous then, and I'll take care you shall have reason to, you shall have reason to.
Approaches, seek yon poplar glade, and wait beneath the thick embowering shade. Yourself shall be a witness to my truth.
Thank you.
away, nor ever see me more, unless thou canst my murdered friend restore. Remember all thy fierceness, all thy pride, when poor Philander loved, despaired, and died. That mercy he received, vain him from you, that mercy I return, adieu, adieu.
He's gone, he's gone! The wild inhuman swain, god of my joys, and demon of my pain. His cruelty has fixed the fatal knot. It tears, it rives my bleeding heart.
My hands must kindly feel.
pastoral Corydon and Miranda, music by William Boyce and a libretto by Kitty Clive. And that was the sopranos Julia Gooding and Philippa Hyde, with the tenor Joseph Cornwell, with Opera Restored, directed by Peter Holman. So Kitty Clive had an amazingly successful career, didn't she, Bertha Jonkers? Did she also have a private life?
Not much. She married into the Clive family, best known through the family member, the Clive of India. But she and her husband separated 6 months after the marriage in 1733, and she really just devoted herself to her career thereafter.
But even the most talented performers, I guess, have a sort of shelf life, don't they? At what point did she finally slow down?
After 1755, she sang much less. And when she did sing, it was almost as if she was parodying either herself, or she also had a small industry in lampooning favourite Italian female singers whom she despised. And the London audiences absolutely loved this. So she became known for her mock Italian songs. But the straightforward singing, the Handel and so on, Thomas Arne, that was something that slowly eased off at the end of her career.
So she really became a national treasure, didn't she?
That's how I see her. I see her as a proper British worthy. Normally, we don't really acknowledge, I think, the contributions of women to the London stage and to London's cult and British cultural life. But Clive was really a powerful figure who helped to shape the musical landscape of English playhouses and of the London music industry.
I must say, it's a great shame that we haven't got time, because there's so much fantastic music that's associated with Kitty Clive. What would you say, though, Bertha Jonkers, is her greatest legacy?
I think her greatest legacy is the gorgeous portrait of her, which hangs in the Garrick Club. It shows her holding a piece of music by Handel, and the piece of music she holds is Sweet Bird from Handel's L'Allegro ed il Penseroso. What I love about this portrait, besides the fact that it's beautiful, is that it shows the association she had with Handel, but above all, it shows what her reputation was. She was the sweet bird of Drury Lane.
Thank you for joining us.
The End of the Air, Sweet Bird, from Handel's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso ed Il Moderato. And that ends today's edition of the Early Music Show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping, who was talking to Bertha Jonkers. Well, in tomorrow's programme, Lucy presents music by two Italian composers and violinists from the 17th century, Tarquinio Merula and Marco Uccellini. That's at the same time, just after the 1 o'clock news here on BBC Radio 3. Don't forget, though, that you can also download a podcast version of the show every week. All you have to do is go to the Radio 3 homepage, and then you follow the links to the Early Music Show pages.
Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. Shostakovich's most celebrated symphony and Rachmaninoff at his most irresistible. The Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, live in Radio 3 Live in Concert. Wednesday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, in an hour from now, British symphonic music is to the fore. You can hear part of George Lloyd's mammoth Fourth Symphony, also songs by Finzi Butterworth and Cecil Sharp, and a trombone concerto by Gordon Jacob. Just some of the offerings from Simon Heffer's tour of British music of the 20th century in Saturday Classics on Radio 3 at 3 o'clock this afternoon. But now, with the time just after 2 o'clock, we're off to Wigmore Hall in London, the venue for our live relays here on Radio 3 every Monday lunchtime. Last Monday, our lunchtime concert was presented by Sarah Walker.
Today, Wigmore Hall plays host to one of the world's most admired chamber ensembles, the Tokarch Quartet. They were formed in 1975 in Budapest, and since 1983 they've been based in the USA as resident quartet of the University of Boulder, Colorado. But London is also very close to their hearts. In fact, the quartet have just been named associate artists here at Wigmore Hall. It's a position that's awarded on a long-term basis to internationally acclaimed groups who play a really important part in the venue's programming over many years to come. So an exciting time for the Tokarczuk. And today they're going to play two works for us, Dvořák's Quartet in E-flat, opus 51, and first of all, the quartet by Haydn, The Lark. The nickname, which doesn't come from Haydn, stems from the first movement. There's a beautiful melodic line for the first violin, which soars up into the top register, while the other instruments play more earthbound music beneath. But that's not the quartet's only claim to fame. It has a fabulous finale too, a so-called moto perpetuo, where the semiquavers never seem to stop. So to perform Haydn's String Quartet in D, opus 64, number 5, The Lark, here is the Tokarczuk Quartet.
Thank you.